Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognized specialist in veterinary anesthesia and analgesia, Louise Clark. Thank you, Louise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you to those of you who've joined us on the lunchtime and to those of you who are listening to this later over a glass of wine. I think that's probably preferable. To let you know, we're going to go through anesthesia of patients with intracranial disease. There's a lot of information on my slides, slightly deliberately, so you can take time to read them yourselves. Probably won't cover all of it. Really, what we're going to look at is what do I do with a patient when I've got intracranial disease and I want to do something with it. Essentially, a lot of the things that we need to do in order to either get a diagnosis or to treat these patients involve anesthesia. So we may be anesthetizing a patient for MRI and CSF, for survey imaging if we're looking for metastatic changes, for surgery potentially, especially if you're working in a referral institute, or for radiotherapy. These patients are high risk. They have a very high risk of intraoperative complications. And it's quite common to see clinical deterioration post-anesthesia if the anesthetic's not managed well. And this is actually quite a common presentation that we see, that a patient will come to our neurologists, and one of the things that's relevant in their history is that they've had an anesthetic and their clinical picture has deteriorated afterwards. This is because poorly managed anesthesia, if you like, tips patients over the edge. They have no clinical reserve, and what we would get away with a healthy patient, we cannot get away with these patients. So what I'm going to try and do going forward through this presentation is to talk to you about some of the relevant physiology. I appreciate if you're listening to this at 9 o'clock at night, you're thinking, really? But the physiology is really important. It's not just the drugs. If you understand what's going on in the brain when there is raised intracranial pressure, you get a better understanding of how you, as you interact with the patient, actually can affect that. So when we're anesthetizing these patients, what we need to make sure ultimately is that we've got adequate oxygen delivery to the cerebral tissue. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. We've got adequate cerebral perfusion pressure because blood is carrying oxygen. We've got adequate glucose because we want to make sure that we've got the glucose to be metabolized. Without glucose, if we get hypoglycemia, then we've got a problem. Ideally, our anesthetic agents want to be cerebroprotective. We'll talk further about that later on. And what we don't want to do definitively is increase intracranial pressure further. That's a really bad idea. And that's the first thing that we'll talk about in terms of what we want to get from an anesthetic. So if we think about the skull, it's essentially a rigid, non-compliant box. And inside it, there is a brain, there is blood, and there is a CSF. That's what's in a normal skull. And the intracranial pressure is determined by the relative volumes of the different contents. Normal intracranial pressure would be less than 15 millimeters of mercury in all cases. If we think about this from a kind of an imaging perspective, we've got a brain that's pretty much incompressible. The volume of the brain is the volume of the brain. So any increase in other contents, and these are essentially the blood or the CSF, will elevate ICP. If you have a mass within the brain or swelling of the brain, that will clearly also elevate ICP. So if one of them increases, it must occur at the expense of the other two. And this has a name for those sitting exams. It's called the Monroe-Kelly Doctrine from a couple of Edinburgh physicians. But what it essentially means is that you have a box with stuff in it. And in this case, if we look at this diagram, if we have a normal brain and then we have a lesion inside that brain, that increases the volume of the brain. It increases CSF displacement and potentially increases total volume inside that. You're then ultimately potentially going to get an increase in pressure, potentially brain herniation. what actually happens is that initially, as the volume goes up, that box can compensate. It squeezes CSF out and it squeezes blood out. Those are not good. We need the blood to supply the brain with oxygen, but the animal can just about cope. We get to a point, which is seen by the arrow on this curve, where at that point of flexion of the curve, the compensation mechanisms are completely exhausted, and a very small increase in volume will lead to a massive increase in pressure. And at this point, if in a clinical situation, this is when you're likely to get herniation, because there is no compensation, it's absolutely exhausted. So what we want to try and do is make sure that we keep this animal in the lower part of the curve, if at all possible. We need to be aware that an animal that has a mass inside its brain, or, for example, inflammatory brain disease with general increase in volume, that will already contribute to an increased pressure. What we don't want is for that to increase massively. And as I said earlier, in order to function properly, the brain needs oxygen and glucose. And they need to be delivered by blood, obviously, but we need enough blood, but not too much blood. The issue is, if we have excessive blood, that essentially is sitting there inside the cranial vault, contributing to an increased intracranial pressure, but not actually a benefit to the tissue. So we need enough blood to get to the tissue, but not too much. We also need the blood to have an adequate hemoglobin. Many cases with chronic intracranial disease, or as part of a chronic ongoing problem, will be anemic. Many of the cats that we see with meningiomas are moderately anemic. We don't know exactly what the optimal hematocrit for these patients is, but it's definitely higher than in general. This basically means that you need to have an adequate hemoglobin, but not an excessive hemoglobin. What you might consider reasonable in a patient that is otherwise, maybe a patient otherwise in the hospital, will not be adequate for these patients, because the brain is incredibly vulnerable to hypoxia. Only the brain and the heart are essentially organs that cannot run anaerobically. They're aerobic organs. They need oxygen. They need glucose. And if that brain is deprived of oxygen, then you'll see damage, and you'll see damage very quickly. You'll see damage from profound hypoxia within 4 minutes, and you'll see brain death within 6 minutes. So it's really, really important that you are giving enough blood to this brain. And as I said, the brain is really oxygen dependent, and it takes a massive amount of cardiac output. If we think about it, it's only a small organ, even in the human. It takes 15% of cardiac output, and grey matter takes somewhere in the region of 3 to 5 times as much oxygen as white matter. It's a massive oxygen requirement, so we need to make sure that oxygen is being delivered to this brain. And the most important thing for you to kind of remember from this is that we need adequate perfusion pressure, but we don't need too much blood. We need enough blood, but not enough so that we finish up with an excess, which will contribute to raised intracranial pressure. So the cerebral perfusion pressure, which is the driving pressure to deliver blood to that brain, is the mean arterial pressure minus the intracranial pressure, or the CVP, whichever is the higher. So what we need to think about is that in an animal where the intracranial pressure is elevated, in order to maintain an adequate cerebral perfusion pressure, we need a higher blood pressure in order to drive blood to overcome the intracranial pressure. So, for example, those of you who are interested in anesthesia will know that a general mean arterial pressure that we think adequate for perfusion is around about 60 millimeters of mercury. That's fine, unless you have an animal with an elevated ICP, because a mean arterial pressure of 60 minus an ICP of 20 will only give you a cerebral perfusion pressure of 40. That's not enough. Cerebral perfusion pressure needs to be at least 50 millimeters. So that's actually going to be something that we can manage during anesthesia. Keep the mean arterial pressure high, to help deliver oxygen to the brain. In a healthy brain, the amount of cerebral blood flow, i.e. that we have enough blood but not too much, is well regulated. So enough will get there to meet the demands of the brain, so that we've got enough oxygen and we've got enough glucose. Unfortunately, that only happens over a specific mean arterial pressure, which is basically between a mean arterial pressure of 50 and 150. So that's maintained by autoregulation, where you get vasodilation or vasoconstriction of blood vessels in order to maintain enough blood going there. Outside this, blood flow will depend on mean arterial pressure. So if the animal is allowed to become hypotensive, even with a normal brain, the amount of cerebral blood flow will fall. If the animal is allowed to become hypotensive in a case where there is damage to the brain and the autoregulation is lost, this will happen even more. So autoregulation only is maintained in healthy brain tissue. Pressure autoregulation is lost in damaged tissue, and this is something that you need to be aware of. Equally, as well as the blood flow affected by pressure, we also have chemical effects on the blood flow. This is very important when we're thinking about animals that are anaesthetized. Under anaesthesia, as a rule, animals don't ventilate particularly well. If ventilation is poor, arterial CO2 rises, vasodilation occurs, and this increases cerebral blood flow. Cerebral blood flow increases beyond the optimal, then you finish up with a rise in intracranial pressure. This is really important because most people don't manage the carbon dioxide, their end-tidal CO2, adequately in animals that are anaesthetized. We need to make sure that the end-tidal CO2 is kept within physiological norms. We'll talk more about that later, but that's a really important aspect of managing animals under anaesthesia with raised intracranial pressure. Equally, if you think, well, you know, high CO2 is a bad thing, I'll reduce it. If you reduce the carbon dioxide beyond about 25 millimeters of mercury, you get vasoconstriction. And that vasoconstriction will actually compromise tissue oxygen delivery. So we've got to reach a compromise. Historically, they used to hyperventilate patients. That would drop the CO2. And that will reduce intracranial pressure, but it will also reduce blood supply to the brain, which isn't a good idea. Equally, if you've got a problem with delivery of oxygen, if your arterial oxygen tension drops, your cerebral blood flow will increase, which again is a negative thing. So we really need to be controlling the carbon dioxide by ventilation and the oxygen by adequate anaesthetic management in other respects to make sure that we optimize cerebral blood flow. So this is really just to reiterate. The brain takes 15% of cardiac output, pretty much 20% of your body's basal oxygen requirements. That is an awful lot. If you're not getting oxygen to the right tissues in the brain in the right quantities, you're going to cause this animal a problem. So this is just what we call flow metabolism coupling. This is quite a complicated concept, and you really don't need to know much about it. But what it's essentially saying is this is cerebral metabolic rate for oxygen, and this is cerebral blood flow. And what it's really saying is that as cerebral metabolic oxygen consumption goes up, the amount of cerebral blood flow needs to go up. So if your brain needs more oxygen for any reason, the amount of blood flow it needs goes up. That's fine, except some of the anaesthetic drugs we use wreck this. They will do things such as increase cerebral blood flow when we don't have a high demand for oxygen. So if you have an animal that has a lot of cerebral vasodilation that we were talking about earlier, so either from carbon dioxide or from some of the anaesthetic drugs, you've got too much blood and not enough oxygen requirement, and you finish up with what we call hyperemia, too much blood in the area. In an ideal situation, you will match your cerebral blood flow to your cerebral oxygen requirement, and you will use drugs that actually enable this to happen. We'll talk about that later. The other situation would be where your cerebral demand for oxygen goes up, but your cerebral blood flow goes down. And this might be a case because you hyperventilate the patient, you drop the CO2 too much, or that you damage it, you drop your cerebral perfusion so much that you're not delivering enough cerebral blood flow in order to meet the requirements of the brain. And as you can imagine, rather than having too much blood, you now don't have enough blood, and the brain becomes ischemic. So, if we think about an unhealthy brain, so an animal that has inflammatory brain disease, a tumour, head trauma, cerebral autoregulation is lost. That cerebral blood flow becomes pressure dependent. And as I said earlier, if you have a low mean arterial pressure, your cerebral blood flow is then massively affected. And if we've got a cerebral perfusion pressure less than 50 millimetres of mercury, you'll definitely get ischemia. And some of the literature says 60 millimetres. So therefore, we're trying to maintain a cerebral perfusion pressure, ideally greater than 70 millimetres of mercury. So if we said earlier that cerebral perfusion pressure is the mean arterial pressure minus the intracranial pressure, you can see now that we basically need to be looking at a fairly high mean arterial pressure in order to maintain an adequate cerebral perfusion pressure. So that's something to think about in terms of anaesthetic. So that's the physiology. Just try and keep that in the background, and it may be worth going over it again. It is complicated, but it gives you a fundamental understanding of what's going on with blood flow and pressures inside that cranial vault, and that's really important if you're actually thinking about managing these cases. So before we even think about anaesthesia, we need to think about the whole patient. We need to think about management of hypoxia. Need to think about management of hypoperfusion. So is the whole patient adequately perfused? Have we got adequate mean arterial pressure in the conscious animal? Have we got adequate perfusion? Is this patient ventilating correctly? Has it got a problem that means it can't ventilate properly? That may be completely unrelated to the problem that it's presented to you for other reasons. It may not be ventilating well. You need to think about the whole patient. Then, and only then, do we think about the specific management of intracranial pressure. If you aggressively manage intracranial pressure in the face of hypoperfusion, you're still not going to have adequate cerebral perfusion pressure. So think about the whole patient first. And I know this, the whole neurology club is being run by Simon and Ron, and it's worth having a look at their manual of neurological emergencies, because this has a chapter which I was involved in which looks specifically at how you manage these patients before you even think about the neurology aspect or the anaesthesia aspect. So first thing is get your patient as stable as you possibly can. And the next thing is, do not sedate them. Anaesthesia is much safer than sedation. If you think about it, if you watch the TV and watch these the HEMS services, the helicopter emergency services, if they've got a patient who's had head trauma, what do? They anaesthetize, paralyze, intubate, ventilate on site. Okay? That's optimal management. We'll come on to that in a bit. And they're not going to sedate that patient. All sedation does is depress the cardiovascular system and impair ventilation. Most of the sedation drugs have quite profound effects that are negative, and this contributes to secondary neuronal injury, and it also makes neurological assessment difficult. What we want to be able to do is get this patient transitioned quickly from conscious to unconscious, do what we need to do, and then transition them as quickly as we can from unconscious, safely to conscious so that ongoing neurological assessment is possible. The worst thing you can do with these patients is sedate them with medetomidine and butorphanol. You'll depress their ventilation. You'll have all sorts of secondary effects. You'll have huge effects on cerebral perfusion, pressure, cardiac output, etc. If there's one thing you take home from this, don't sedate sick brain patients. As I said, we wanted to maintain adequate perfusion pressure, so we need a fairly high mean arterial pressure. So we want to make sure they've got an adequate circulating volume, which should be addressed during stabilization, ideally, if they're very hypovolemic. So if this animal is a head trauma that's been involved in an RTA, we want to make sure that we've got an adequate circulating volume. We want to make sure that we avoid drugs that cause profound hypotension themselves. We want to avoid drugs that interfere with cerebral blood flow. We don't want too much cerebral blood flow. We don't want intracranial vasodilation. And drugs like isoflurane are not particularly good for these patients. I appreciate that not everybody has other things available, but if we really want to avoid volatile agents such as isoflurane, if we can. We want to minimize intracranial pressure. Now, this has been covered in some of the other neurology clubs, but from an anesthesia perspective specifically, there are certain things that we need to think about which are slightly different from managing ICP in the conscious animal. We're going to need to ventilate this patient because most animals, when anaesthetized, don't ventilate as well as they do conscious, whatever agents you use, just partly because of the resistance of the breathing system and because of the drugs. You want to avoid excessive airway pressures. If you have very high pressures on your ventilator, this tends to affect venous return and it tends to affect CVP. If you like, when you put high pressures in there, you back up the circulation. You, by inflating the lungs, you affect venous drainage, you increase CVP and you increase ICP. So if you're going to ventilate, do it gently. Most commercial ventilators are perfectly adequate, but you just need to think about this. You want to have an arterial CO2 of between about 35 and 40 millimetres of mercury. Now, that's fine if you've got blood gas analysis, but if you haven't, just make sure your end-tidal CO2 is a little bit lower. So an end-tidal CO2 of between 30 and 35 millimetres of mercury will allow for a normal physiological difference. And this will mean that you're going to be about where you need to be with your arterial CO2. If you are brave enough to be doing things like intracranial surgery, then you shouldn't be doing that without adequate access to blood gases, because what you want to be really certain of is that that difference is what you think it is. You really want to be looking at arterial CO2. But in a situation, if you're maybe just imaging a patient or doing something in the short term, you want to maintain the end-tidal CO2 30-35 millimetres. You want to make sure that there is adequate venous drainage in other respects. Don't use a collar and neck lead. You get massive venous occlusion and you get jugular occlusion, which affects intracranial pressure. Don't let them pull, like in that respect. And when they're positioned, put them about 15 to 30 degrees head up. This will optimize the balance between cerebral perfusion pressure and venous drainage. What you don't want to do is have their neck kinked laterally, though, because this won't help. So just prop them up, but no more than 30 degrees elevated. You want to maintain adequate oxygenation. So pre-oxygenate, stick a mask over their head with a high amount of oxygen on. They will tend to desaturate during induction. You want to monitor the SpO2 and ideally the PaO2 throughout. So in a non-invasive situation, in MRI, we would use pulse oximetry, but it's worth using blood gases if you have them available. If you're checking arterial CO2, by definition, you always get both of those. And if you can interpret those together, that's much better. So you want to avoid a PaO2 of less than 80 millimetres of mercury. More oxygen is not necessarily better, and we'll come onto that a bit later. But we do want to make sure they're adequately oxygenated. And this is particularly true if an animal is borderline anemic, because if they're borderline anemic, they're not going to be carrying as much oxygen as they should be in the blood. So you want to make sure that, all the hemoglobin is carrying oxygen. So provide oxygen in recovery as well. We want to try and decrease the amount of oxygen that the brain is using. We said it takes 15% of cardiac output, 20% of metabolic oxygen consumption. That's quite a lot. What we'd like to do is reduce cerebral metabolic oxygen consumption if we can, because this will actually be cerebroprotective. It will help maintain as much homeostasis as we can. So avoid drugs that increase it. We want to maintain normothermia or mild hypothermia. What you do not ever want is a patient to shiver, because this massively increases the total body oxygen consumption. And we think about our drugs. This is where some of the drugs do have an influence on what's going on inside that brain. And when we're actually anaesthetizing them, we need to think about what's going on. If you intubate a patient who is, inverted commas, light, you will get a massive increase in blood pressure and a massive increase in intracranial pressure. If you intubate a patient who coughs, and I've seen this, I've seen a patient die coughing at induction because they were so borderline and the cough was enough to increase the intracranial pressure to tip them to the point where they're herniated. So just make sure that your attention to detail with anesthesia is meticulous. Gentle, calm induction with oxygen, laryngoscopy. We sometimes will talk about what we're actually going to do, but we want to avoid them coughing. We sometimes use lidocaine. There's no point anaesthetizing a stress patient. You need to get control of them to make sure that they're calm and that they're adequately analgesed. And as we said before, make sure that they're hemodynamically stable. Fluids and potentially inotropes, depending on situation that they're in. So, lots of background. We should do this, we shouldn't do that. But what are we actually going to do when this patient is in front of you? I guess that's what you actually really want to know. So, if we go back to our kind of traditional approach, if we think about the different aspects or different bits of anesthesia, pre-anesthetic medication. We want to reduce stress and anxiety. We want to reduce the amount of induction agent and the amount of maintenance agent. We want analgesia. We want a nice smooth recovery. But what we don't want are changes in cerebral perfusion pressure, cerebral blood flow, or ventilation. That's quite a difficult ask. Most of the drugs that we use are going to have some effects, and we'll just talk briefly about those drugs. Ideally, we want to avoid ACP in a patient with raised intracranial pressure. It will cause cerebral vasodilation. It's also a very long-acting drug, particularly in this situation. We also want to avoid high doses of alpha-2 agonists. Now, there's a lot of information coming from human practice suggesting that very low doses of dexmedetomidine are a useful adjunct to neuroanesthesia, but if you're looking at it from the standpoint of a practitioner, it's safer to avoid alpha-2 agonists, particularly at the standard datasheet doses. For example, as a comparator, the standard datasheet dose for medetomidine for sedation is 10 mics per kilo. In a sick brain, if I was going to use it, I'd be using between a 20th and a 10th of that dose. So can use them safely, but you certainly cannot use them safely at datasheet doses. So it's probably something to avoid, and we don't tend to use them unless the animal's temperament or clinical situation requires it. You also want to avoid morphine, just because IV morphine causes vomiting. Vomiting is another thing that massively increases intracranial pressure. Most of the other opioids, methadone, butorphanol, those are all sensible choices. So what would we do? Phenobarbital. Remember, you might be loading a patient with phenobarb because it's having cluster seizures or something like that. It's actually an agent that markedly reduces MAC. It reduces the amount of induction agent and it reduces the amount of maintenance agent. So MAC is the amount of volatile agent, if you like, or injectable agent to maintain anesthesia. And just phenobarb alone will have quite a marked effect, especially if the patient's completely loaded up to 15, 18 milligrams per kilo. So if you've got phenobarb on board, you need to consider that. Other opioids, we tend to use at conservative doses to avoid respiratory depression, and we use them when we're present. So we would often use a very low dose of methadone or a low dose of butorphanol, but we'll administer that intravenously, titrated to effect with somebody present. Then if something does happen, we can deal with it very quickly. And it's occasional, but it does happen sometimes. What I wouldn't do is give a patient with clearly elevated ICP a decent dose of butorphanol IM and leave it in a kennel because you may find it in a coma within 15 to 20 minutes. It's a bit of a standing joke here, but we do have diagnosis by opioid. If we give a low dose of opioid and we see a very profound sedation, then we're almost certainly dealing with an animal with raised intracranial pressure. That's partly because of the overt sensitivity to these drugs, and also because there's probably a degree of respiratory depression even at low doses in these particular patients. So opioids, yes, definitely. Opioids at low doses, IV with care. We'll often give benzodiazepines, but normally in combination with an induction agent. Most of these patients will be pretty sleepy unless they're some occasionally disinhibited, but just on an opioid. Benzodiazepines we'll use as well at induction of anesthesia. We don't tend to use them in the pre-anesthetic medication intramuscularly, just because we get such variable effect with them. And in dogs, we will almost certainly give intravenous lidocaine at induction of anesthesia because there's slightly controversial data, but there is enough data to suggest that it attenuates the response to intubation. What we don't want is this patient to cough. And there are a couple of studies out there suggesting that the coughing frequency is reduced in these animals. You can give it to cats, but you need to be very, very careful. The toxic dose in cats is much lower than in dogs, so we tend not to, and we will just spray the larynx really, really effectively. Make sure our anesthesia plane is adequate and that we intubate really gently, and that's normally okay. You definitely, for a cat in this situation, need a laryngoscope because you do not want to touch the larynx. You want to make sure you intubate without actually touching the through the rema, without touching the cartilages, and then you won't get them coughing. When you're anesthetizing, you want it you want the situation to be that you go from pre-anesthetic medication to induction of anesthesia over a fairly short period of time. You want smooth and high quality induction, no struggling. If you have a patient that you've given a pre-anesthetic agent to, maybe a little bit of butorphanol, and it's not doing what you want to do, you've got a patient that's struggling, that's aggressive, then that's a situation where I might consider a very low dose of alpha-2 agonist, so a very low dose of medetomidine or dexmedetomidine. As I said, 20th to a 10th of the standard dose, and then you give it incrementally. Once we've got a patient that is settled, calm, we can pre-oxygenate. We want to anesthetize with an intravenous agent. You get rapid airway control, you can then intubate rapidly and get IPPV. The agent was, to an extent, there are advantages and disadvantages. Propofol does not markedly affect cerebral metabolic oxygen or cerebral blood flow. So this would tend to be our standard agent. A lot of veterinary practices are using alfaxolone. My only query with alfats alone is that we don't have the raw data, the basic science data, to show exactly what's going on, because this is a veterinary-only drug. It's not used in the human market. So therefore, these cases, we know definitively that propofol is good for the brain in this situation. So I would definitely, given the choice, use propofol over alfaxolone in these particular cases. Barbiturates are useful if they're available. Phytopentone is a very good choice, but it's just not available anymore. Ketamine, it has questions after it. Historically, and even if you read fairly recent books, people said don't use ketamine because it increases cerebral metabolic oxygen requirement. And there's also some really dodgy data about lowering the seizure threshold. That's as lowering the seizure threshold has pretty much been discounted. It's old data from goats that they were actually referring to. It will affect CMRO2, but ketamine also has the massive advantage of being a very good analgesic, and it also supports the circulation. So it has now become the drug of choice for most helicopter-based emergency services that are anaesthetizing and intubating head trauma at the roadside. So for this reason, ketamine is no longer banned. Ketamine is actually a very useful drug. Get very, very good analgesia. You can get good airway control. And the increase in cerebral metabolic oxygen requirement is more than offset by the support of the circulation and maintaining cerebral perfusion pressure. So that may be a slightly academic argument for most of us, but it's worth making because in a lot of the veterinary literature, they say don't use ketamine in these cases. And actually, if you go out with London Hens, they will use ketamine in all their nearly all their head trauma cases. So that's, I think that's adequate information itself to say that we shouldn't avoid ketamine. Make sure they don't cough at intubation. We've already mentioned that. And monitor your anaesthetic. This is really, really important. The drugs are important, but monitoring is even more important. You want to know that your patient is stable and you want to manage it effectively. As for which maintenance agent, ideally you want to decrease cerebral metabolic oxygen demand. You don't want to affect autoregulation. You want a patient that recovers rapidly. You don't want this drug to hang around for hours, and it wouldn't have any effect on the cardiovascular system. Nice try, but there are no agents like that out there, not a single one. So what we have to do is think about what we is best for each animal in each situation. But we can have some general guidelines that makes it easier to do. So first thing, if you've got nitrous in the practice, don't use it in these cases. It's increases cerebral blood flow, it's a vasodilator, and it affects cerebral oxygen demand. So just turn it off for these cases. Okay. Volatile agents. They all suppress cerebral metabolic oxygen demand, but they also cause cerebral vasodilation. There's a lot of information on this slide. I'm going to leave it for you to read later. But the bottom line is that if we're going to use a volatile agent, sevoflurane has big advantages over isoflurane. It maintains flow metabolism coupling. You don't get a huge amount of cerebral vasodilation, so cerebral blood flow remains better, certainly if you keep the concentrations low. And there are, the neuroanaesthetist at Addenbrooke's in Cambridge do use sevoflurane. So if we're going to maintain anaesthesia with a volatile agent, the ideal agent is sevoflurane. It really is markedly better than isoflurane in this particular context. Propofol, as a maintenance agent, reduces cerebral blood flow, reduces ICP, preserves autoregulation. It's been associated with cerebral ischemia, but it probably is the maintenance agent of choice where it's suitable in that particular candidate. And we need to think about our particular patient. If you have an animal that's having a short MRI, then it's going to be probably no major advantage to have to go to the difficulty of setting up a propofol infusion. However, if you have a really sick patient that the neurologist is going to be doing intracranial surgery on, then propofol probably has advantages, except in cats, and we need to be aware of this. They don't metabolize propofol efficiently, so you get very prolonged recoveries in cats. You may get oxidative damage to the red cells, and you get Heinz body anemia. It's not common, but in very prolonged procedures, it might be an issue. There's a question as to whether alfaxolone has a role in these cases, but we really don't have good data as yet. Certainly, alfaxolone, it can be used for anesthesia in cats, but as to exactly what happens inside the cranial vault, we just don't have that much good information. So, what are our options overall? Potentially, all of the above have been reported. So sevoflurane plus an opioid of any description. Now for surgery, we'd normally use a short-acting infused opioid. Less of an issue for MRI imaging. We will just use the volatile and whatever is in the pre-anesthetic medication. But essentially what you're looking for is either sevoflurane or propofol as your maintenance agent together with an opioid. Either the opioid in the pre-med or the opioid in the pre-med plus a short-acting titratable opioid. The reason for that is just that it markedly reduces the amount of either propofol or sevoflurane that you're using. But things like remifentanil, alfentanil are quite difficult drugs to use, and they're things that you need to have a little bit of understanding about what's going on with them to use them. So from a pragmatic perspective, if we're MRIing a patient, 90% of our patients with raised intracranial pressure, we will maintain anesthesia, ventilated with all the other caveats, with sevoflurane. If we're going to theatre with them, then it will really depend on their clinical status as to what we do. As I said before, cerebral perfusion pressure greater than 70 millimetres of mercury, so we should be looking at a mean arterial pressure around about 80. Ideally, in a big case, you want to be monitoring that directly, so arterial catheter. If you don't have that available for MRI, for imaging, non-invasive may be adequate for short procedures where your patient's reasonably stable. And that's, again, pragmatically what we'll do for most patients in MRI. Probably 80 to 90% of them will use a non-invasive approach, although we will place arterial catheters for some of the more compromised ones. It really depends on what you've got available, but ideally, direct monitoring will allow you to then titrate inotropes, pressors, to maintain that pressure a lot more accurately. And ventilate your patients, so no high airway pressures, CO2, 30 to 35 millimetres of mercury in terms of end-tidal. Avoid dropping it too low, watch your airway pressures, and ideally in a longer case you'd want to check those numbers against blood gas analysis. And this is what we looked at before, but just to reiterate, if your PaCO2 becomes elevated, then you will get a degree of cerebral vasodilation and an increase, an inappropriate increase in cerebral blood flow. So want to keep your end-tidal CO2 within physiological ranges. And a PaCO2 of 7.5, if you think about that in terms of what you might be more familiar with, that's only an end-tidal CO2 in the low 50s. And most animals, if you actually measure it, under anesthesia will have an end-tidal CO2 of pushing 50 or thereabouts. So you do really need to be on top of this in order to do the best for them. We need to make sure that these patients are adequately oxygenated, but there isn't a massive benefit to giving loads and loads of oxygen. Pulmonary function is better maintained under anesthesia with a mixture of air and oxygen. So if you've got it, that's absolutely fine. use air, and it will, you just want to use enough oxygen in the mixture to maintain your SpO2 greater than 95% and your PaO2 greater than 80%. If you're dealing with long cases, like particularly if you've got a case that maybe goes to MRI and is something like a brain abscess that then needs surgery, you want to avoid long-term hyperoxia. You will see damage to the lungs after 100% of oxygen for not very long periods. So ideally, you do not want to be using that amount of oxygen for that period of time. So ideally, we want to be using an air-oxygen mixture if we possibly can. If you haven't got it, that's absolutely fine. For an MRI, anything like that, oxygen is absolutely fine. It's just if you're doing prolonged procedures, it's much better to use an air-oxygen mixture if you've got it. And I alluded to this a minute ago, but if we're doing invasive stuff, adequate analgesia is really important. An infusion of a ultra-potent, short-acting opioid is the most easy way of doing this. They're short-acting, which allows us to recover the patients, allow them to recover from anesthesia very quickly, and we're going to be ventilating these patients anyway, so the fact that they cause respiratory depression is really neither here nor there because we've got control of ventilation. If you're going to be using these drugs, it's really important, in fact, I would say imperative, to get a handle on these drugs in non-critical patients. So use them, get used to them, know what they do. They're very, very potent, particularly alfentanil and remifentanil. If you're used to maybe giving a bit of fentanyl here and there, that's a Ford Escort. Alfentanil is more like a really souped up Porsche, and you can cause some profound problems with it if you don't understand how it works. So great drugs, but read about them and use them in non-critical patients before you start playing with them in these patients. That's not a good idea. As we said before, maintain venous drainage, but make sure the neck isn't kinked and don't elevate the head above 30 degrees. Avoid restraint around the head. So if you're doing big cases and you're going to be putting central catheters in, they need to go in through the saphenous, not through the jugular, if you can avoid them. And it's perfectly easy to place a big central catheter through the median saphenous in a cat. It's probably easier in honesty than placing it through the jugular, but that's the way that I would approach big vascular access. What you don't want is a big jugular in an animal that already has raised intracranial pressure. If we're doing surgery on these guys, we tend to paralyze them as well. It just makes it easier for the surgeon. It's more of a balanced anesthetic technique, and it just makes management from our perspective easier. It's not something that we do for MRI, for imaging, for that kind of stuff. It's really only when we're thinking about surgery. Fluid therapy is going to be guided by cardiovascular performance and the necessity to manage intracranial pressure. It's basically a big talk in itself, this, and there is more information in other neurology webinars. But what you're trying to do is optimize cardiac performance and minimize intracranial pressure. One thing to note is that Hartmann's is slightly hypotonic. And if you give large volumes in a head trauma patient, you will cause cerebral edema. We want to maintain body temperature. If they get hot, they get an increase in metabolic oxygen demand, an increase in cerebral blood flow. And as we know, those aren't good. Being cold, there are advocates of this in the veterinary profession, but they possibly don't understand the ramifications. If your patient is an uncontrolled hypothermic and is undergoing surgery, you're going to get bradycardia, hypotension, delayed recoveries, You'll get coagulopathy, be below 35.5 degrees. Blood doesn't clot normally. Blood loss is a massive issue in intracranial surgery in our patients because we just don't have the blood available that you can pour into people. You get delayed wound healing. You get a higher risk of infection because of a compromised immune system. And you get shivering in recovery. So what we would say is that if they're having surgery, in fact, if they're doing anything, you want to keep them normothermic, but don't let them get hot. We just don't have in veterinary practice the ability to ventilate and paralyze these patients for hours after surgery in order to actually stabilize everything. You're going to, if you try and make these patients cold, you're potentially going to set yourself up with loads and loads of problems. So our issues at the moment are essentially that we can't measure intracranial pressure routinely. There are methods of doing so that are routine in human practice, but they're just not either financially viable or practicable in our cases. It may be that those systems are going to get easier to manage and that we can use. At the moment, we've got jugular bulb venous oxygen saturation is really looking at cerebral oxygen extraction, cerebral delivery versus return, which looks at oxygen extraction. And that has a big role in people in the management of in neuro-ICU. When we're recovering these patients from anesthesia, we want to make sure that they're comfortable, they're warm, their CO2 is within normal limits, they're oxygenating well, their blood pressure is okay but not too high, and they're not anemic. A relatively large number of intracranial cases require blood transfusion, and that blood needs to be given before you recover them. The highest oxygen demand is early in recovery when they may be a bit cold, a bit shivery, they're a bit hypoxic. You must, if you're going to need to transfuse, you need to start that on the table, and you need to make sure that the PCV is adequate before you wake them up. You need to think about nutrition. They're often NPO, depending on the location of the lesion, for 24 to 36 hours after surgery. Whatever, however we approach this anesthetic, we'd like to get them recovered fairly quickly so that we can see what the neurological function is like. But this mustn't be at the expense of agitation. And again, one of the things that we will often do is give very, very low doses of alpha-2 if they do get particularly fractious. But the best thing you can do for them is a very quiet environment, have stuff available for immediate reintubation just in case, avoid drugs causing respiratory depression, so stop those short-acting opioids if you're using them very early on. Be cautious with your general opioids, things like methadone. Make sure that you're ventilating them until they can breathe really well by themselves, and this applies in any situation. When you extubate them, make sure that they don't cough, make sure that they recover really quietly. And we have used beta blockade in patients with persistent hypertension, but that's really only during recovery from surgical cases. And it's unusual. It tends to be dogs rather than cats. Allow them to recover with oxygen, but don't use nasal prongs. They'll tend to just make them sneeze or cough, and that will affect intracranial pressure. Make sure that you've got good nursing care, nurses that know what they're doing. Make sure that ideally you don't sedate if you have to until you've got some baseline neurological assessment. And certainly for any kind of intracranial surgery, you definitely need to want to have ICU care available just so that these patients can be looked after properly. So just a few points to finish. These are really just what do we do in specific patient types, just so that we can get an idea of what we need to do and what we don't need to do. These guys, we need to think about specifically about the whole patient. If they've had head trauma, they may well have comorbidities. That's your most important thing. And you probably also want to avoid large volumes of hypertonic solutions. So anything containing glucose is absolutely contraindicated because the glucose will just affect or will cause neuronal apoptosis. But in this situation, Hartmann's is hypotonic, so I would probably avoid it. If you don't have anything but Hartmann's, that's absolutely fine. But saline is possibly preferable. Hypertonic saline potentially, mannitol potentially, there's lots of discussion relating to those. And as I said before, you really want to target this CPP of at least 70 millimeters of mercury. You want to make sure they've got enough hemoglobin. You want to make sure that they're supplemented with oxygen. And you don't want to hyperventilate them because that will only, in the long term, it'll only decrease the amount of oxygen that their brain's getting. Don't give them steroids. It will just cause hyperglycemia and neuronal apoptosis. Make sure you're controlling seizures effectively. And one thing just to bear in mind is that head trauma can impair thermoregulation, and it can also, if you've got involvement of the hypothalamic pituitary axis, you can definitely get diabetes insipidus, and in the longer term, you can certainly get endocrinopathies as a result of the HPA effects. Probably something that you see a lot more commonly, and we see a lot more commonly, and there's a lot of myth associated. Make sure you've ruled out extracranial causes. You don't want to put something in the MRI scanner that has a portosystemic shunt or something like that. Continue your medications preoperatively. Be aware of the effects of the drugs that you're using for management of seizures on your anesthetics, so particularly phenobarb. Make sure you've got definitive IV access from the time the patient arrives in the hospital, and make sure that you have a seizure plan. It makes our lives as vets an awful lot easier if you've already got a plan, because that means somebody will follow that plan and deal with the problem when they arise. Treat the patient as the patient. Don't worry about ACP. We use it extensively. There's really good evidence now that it does not affect seizure threshold. It doesn't increase the number of seizures. And it is a really good anxiolytic, and in combination with an opioid, makes for good sedation. So we use it all the time. Don't use benzodiazepines alone. You get a lot of dysphoria. Ketamine may potentiate seizures. Questionable. The only thing I'd say is that I wouldn't use ketamine routinely in these cases because the disadvantages outweigh the advantages. Very different from a head trauma. That's a really, you know, a case that's got lots of comorbidity. Propofol is absolutely fine. You know, why the enemy of good is better? Why go away from propofol? Just make sure that they've got a quiet, calm recovery, so they're not likely to seizure in recovery, particularly if they're light sensitive. And we use isoflurane all the time. These patients do not have increased intracranial pressure. They do not have issues related to cerebral perfusion pressure or cerebral blood flow. And all the stuff that we were all taught about at vet school about ACP, don't worry about it, essentially. Treat them as the dog that they are, so sedate them for their temperament and everything else that's going on with them. Just a couple of things for MRI, those of you who are working in the MRI situation. High field magnets potentially present a more hazardous working environment, and you need to be fully cognizant of the risks of the MRI machine to the operator and to the patient before you start getting in there. Microchips cause a lot of interference, and they can be a real pain to manage. We have to surgically remove a lot of them. Patient access is limited. MRI units tend to be very cold. Can't use things like bear huggers. We do use something that's detailed on the slide called a trans warmer. These are neonatal warming devices which are thermostatically, well, they're controlled to a temperature. They're a chemical thing. They're expensive, but they're fantastic for very small patients. Think about ferrous implants in you and your patient, and think about pacemakers. Some of these are patients now. I've had to MRI patients who've got all sorts of other comorbidities. that's what's happening as things get more complex. Some pacemakers we can put through MRI scanners depending on the field, but you need to find that out and think about that very carefully before you go down that road. Make sure that you have adequate training. This is not just a kind of a rant. There have been people and animals killed by MRI equipment. There's been gas cylinders that have been taken into MRI rooms and basically become a projectile across the room. Patient burns from cables. You need specific pulse oximetry and ECG equipment. So make sure if you're going down this road that you're adequately trained before you think about managing animals in the MRI unit. So, at exactly an hour, I think, there's an awful lot there, and I appreciate that there's an awful lot to go through. The physiology is really important because that explains what's going on in there, and it's how the pharmacology interacts with the physiology that's really important. From a practical perspective, the drugs themselves are not that important. They're tools in your toolbox. It's how you use those tools that's really important. And it's meticulous attention to detail in these cases. In these sick cases, you don't get away with it. Okay? As I said, I've seen an animal die at induction at intubation when it coughed and coned. I've also seen an animal cone being transferred from MRI somewhere else where somebody couldn't be bothered to ventilate it during transfer. This is what I've been doing for 15 years. But that said, if you're going to do these patients, you can do them really well, really safely, but you need to think about what you're doing. So with that in mind, thank you very much for your time and attention. Thanks for listening, and I hope that there was some useful information in there. Thanks very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Louise for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.